Space, the final frontier.
These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission, to explore strange new worlds. To boldly go where no one has gone before.
Engage.
Engage.
Kirk Enterprise, Enterprise.
This is Captain Jean-Luc Picard.
Captain Catherine Janeway.
Captain Sisko.
This is Captain Jonathan Archer.
Red alert.
Photon torpedoes, fire.
The official Star Trek podcast.
Engage. Engage.
Make it so.
With your host, Jordan Hoffman.
That, sir, is illogical.
And to make sure history never forgets.
This is Engage.
Hailing frequencies open, sir.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Engage, the official Star Trek podcast. I am your host, Jordan Hoffman, and this is episode number... Brian, what episode number is this? You just rolled your eyes at me when I asked you what...
Is it 53 or 54?
I guess it really doesn't matter. 53, 54. Episode number 50-something of Engage, the official Star Trek podcast.
54.
Hey,
I was right.
All right. Episode 54. We've got a great episode this week. We have a social media star and writer for the New York Times and person who was very much in the news last year during the presidential campaign. Sopan Deb is a writer about politics and culture and sort of the zeitgeist. And he is a huge Star Trek fan. I follow the guy on Twitter, as does, 200,000 of my closest friends. And, he is always making little Star Trek references. And I was on the subway a couple days ago. And I'm like, you know what? Enough's enough. I got to contact this guy. I'm like, dude, you know a lot about Star Trek. Come on the Star Trek podcast. And he's like, I would love to do it. I'm like, how's next week? He goes, absolutely. So... that's why he's coming on today. So that's pretty cool. He'll be on in a little bit, and we're going to talk specifically about TNG, and we're going to talk specifically about small characters, one-shots, guests, special guests. And, there have been a lot of great special guests, characters that you kind of wish you saw more of but didn't. But, that's the way it goes sometimes. So we're going to talk about our top three each. We're going to do bronze, silver, gold, of each. In other news, we're now officially into July. Red alert, I say. Red alert. Because we're not that far away from Discovery. It's coming our way in September. If you follow on social media some of the Discovery production people, they love to take pictures that don't show anything, but they love to take little pictures of themselves. Little animated GIFs of how they're feeling about the production. Everybody's very happy, so that's cool. And the other big news is we're not that far away from the Star Trek convention. If you were listening to my voice and you were on the fence about going to the Star Trek convention in Las Vegas, I would advise you to go. I know it ain't cheap, especially if you don't live in Las Vegas or you don't live where you can drive, but if you have the dough... and you have the time, and you've always wanted to go to a Star Trek convention, this would be the one to go to. For starters, you're going to see a lot of me there. Maybe that's a reason not to go. I don't know. Maybe that's a reason to turn around and get the hell out of there. But I don't want to give too much away about what's going to be happening at this convention, which is in August, very early August. The convention starts on August the 2nd, which is a Wednesday, all the way through August 6th, which is a Sunday. And I'll be there every day, as I always have been for the last few years. But this year I am going to be, whereas I used to host one or two panels a day, now they got me working morning, noon, and night, which is fine with me. But I'm going to be doing a lot of stuff, and we are going to be recording a lot of it also. So the choice material will make it to your ears of the material that I'm hosting, not of the other stuff. I can only record myself. And we're going to be interviewing a lot of cool stuff. That's not really a secret, but the last few years, it's been a main stage and then a secondary stage. And I will be hosting some panels on the secondary stage and even a few on the main stage. But there is a third stage now. It started last year at the recreation of Quark's Bar, which this is at the Rio the Rio Hotel in Las Vegas, in the convention center there, which is huge. They did. They took one of the banquet rooms, and they have a bar there, and you can get snacks, and they got some tables. The lighting is cool. They got a lot of great props. They even have like some games you can play, like Tribble Toss.
Oh, wow.
And they put up a little stage there for like additional stuff. And they started last year, and it went well. So now there's going to be more additional stuff there. So slightly more intimate conversations than is on the main stage. I mean, the main stage is huge. Thousands and thousands of people fit in the main stage. So it's called the Roddenberry stage. And then the second stage. Oh, well, actually, I think now they call it the Nimoy. I think it's called the Roddenberry / Nimoy stage now. And the secondary stage, I think, is still called the DeForest Kelly stage. It doesn't matter. Some, a bigger room, smaller room. And even the second room is still pretty big. So the third room is a little more intimate and shorter conversations with people that run the gamut, from cast members to other fans. We're going to do a lot of games and stuff. It's going to be a lot of fun. And I'm going to be there for a lot of the time, hosting a lot of things, which, you know, like I said, hopefully is a draw. I like to hope it's a draw. I will record an episode of this podcast, too. You know who our guest is going to be?
I don't.
Somebody with the initials T, B, and D.
For a second, I'm thinking like, okay, T? Yeah. Oh, damn it.
No, TBD will be. But, you know, TBD has always done us well in the past. When we did the cruise, my guest for the podcast was TBD, and that ended up being Terry Farrell, Denise Crosby, and Joe Piscopo.
That's
which
right.
Is a real, didn't see that one coming. That just sort of happened. That literally was not planned. That was a whisper in my ear. Hey, Joe Piscopo's here too. You want him to talk? Sure.
I still find that so strange.
It worked out. Well, what was great about that, oh man, was, I don't know if I said this at the time, Terry was the one I asked first, just because I've known Terry for a while, and she's wonderful, and she'd never been on the show. I'm like, Terry, you're on the cruise, I'm on the cruise. Will you come on the podcast if the timing works? She goes, sure. And then I checked in with her again. She's like, oh, I'm going to drag Denise, too. We're going to be together. And I'd already met Denise. I'm like, oh, great, wonderful. So I knew they were coming. And then they sit down, and they're talking. And then I get the whisper, Joe Piscopo's here. He wants to talk, too. I'm like, oh, fabulous. Because it was in front of an audience. I mean, it wasn't a huge audience, but there were people there. So he comes on the stage. He sits down. He says hello. His phone rings. He gets up and leaves. So he says hello, and then he splits for 10, 15 minutes. But then he did come back. So anyway.
I believe he sang.
Yeah, he did. So I don't know what's going to happen at the convention, but that's going to be that. So do consider coming. If you've never come to a Star Trek convention, the Vegas convention's where it's at. It's going to be a lot of fun. I don't want to say specifically what, because I don't know the full brunt of it myself, but needless to say, it's happening in August, and, you know, that's only a good 6 weeks away, 6.5 weeks away from the debut of Discovery. There will be Discovery stuff, you know, not, you know, they're not going to show the whole episode or anything. They may not even show more. There's going to be stuff. I don't even know if it's going to be video stuff. I just know there's going to be stuff. There will be some involvement. You know, there's still going to be shooting, so I don't know who. But I have a high, you know, suspicion that, you know, there's going to be some involvement from Discovery. You're going to know more about Discovery after the convention than you did before. Let's put it that
Hopefully.
Way. Yeah, that's that much is a given. But what? I don't know. And then the whole gang, you know, 100 guests. Mae Jemison is going to be there. NASA astronaut is going to be there. And that's she's someone they've been trying to get for a while. So that's the cool news. What else is cool, Brian, before we get our guest Sopan and Deb on? Is having a solid state hard drive.
Of course it is.
As you know, Western Digital has been sponsoring the show for a couple of weeks now, and Western Digital, WD as I like to call them, is a great, great way to save your stuff, to keep it on a solid state drive. So with WD, you are now able to get solid state drives and hard drives that fit your unique needs. And when you add the superior performance of WD's solid-state drive to your PC, you get blazing read speeds so you can boot your system quickly, load games and other applications in a snap. For games library, direct feed videos, podcasts, and more, all in a single place. So for a limited time, engaged listeners, that's you, can get 20% off select WD solid-state drives with a coupon code. And the coupon code is all one word, WDENGAGE, WDENGAGE. And you can go to WD.com/engage, and you can find out more. Why not save 20%?
Why not?
Be a fool not to. So with that in mind, we are going to take a quick pause and we're going to beam in our guest for today. And we're going to talk deep, deep lore about TNG.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
This is Engage, the official Star Trek podcast.
Energize.
And we're back. Awesome. So it is early July. It's a hot summer. It's not that hot out there. It's a fine summer day. And we have a great guest that we are about to beam in. First of all, wait, is he out there? Let me.
Linda Uhura, open a channel to all decks.
Oh, yeah. We are going to beam him in. That is number three. Whoa! So, Pan, you are...
My gosh.
You
are making my childhood dreams come true right now. This is I used to, as a kid, put on Star Trek, put a little, com badge on my chest and run around the house.
What do you mean, little kid? You were doing this last week.
Yeah, that's right. Right. Yeah. Please don't tell my family about
no
that.
No one knows about this.
Yeah.
So, Sophan Deb, thank you very much for joining us today. You are. What is your current title over at the New York Times? Do you have an official title?
The official title is a culture writer.
Culture writer. Okay.
Yeah, culture reporter. Writer.
You came to. I grew to know you over. Know you. We've met 5 minutes ago, but I grew to know you in the internet at least, where you feel like you know people. Over the past 2 years, as many people did, you were embedded on the Donald Trump campaign.
Right.
And covering that circus with tremendous reportage, but also a lot of humor and the occasional Star Trek quote. So
many, yeah.
These three things came to a head. And while I don't want to give too much commentary about our great leader, President Donald Trump, his campaign wasn't all bad because it brought you to the fore. So that's good.
Oh, well, thank you.
And
I
also,
that.
You know, it's fun. My two great passions in life are Star Trek and the rock band Phish.
Oh, you're a Phishhead.
I am.
Oh,
and someone else who similarly, you know, I don't want to say took advantage of, but whose star rose with the campaign was Katie Turr at NBC, and she's a tremendous Phish fan.
Huge Phish fan.
And is constantly making Phish jokes on television and making Phish fans blow their mind.
Jake Sherman, who is a writer for Politico,
came
on MSNBC with Katie.
Yeah.
And they did an entire segment just talking in Phish lyrics.
It is something that has been analyzed and discussed in the Phish community for quite some time. But this is not the Phish podcast. This is the Star Trek podcast. And I mean, it's pretty amazing, your love of Star Trek. And one can Google your name and Star Trek, and it's not just one or two hits.
Yeah,
it's like 20, it's like 25. So it's pretty sincere stuff. And there's some funny stuff, too. I think that the thing that my favorite, if I was going to do a ranking of your greatest Star Trek moments, was when the great actor F. Murray Abraham wrote, who's a star of theater and film and has won an Academy Award for Amadeus, wrote a very heartfelt note, a letter to the editor at the Times about the Syrian refugee crisis. And F. Murray Abraham is he Syrian? Or I know he's from the Middle East.
I'm not sure. I
think he might be Lebanese, but it's irrelevant. He wrote an article.
He does, but I do know he does a lot of work with refugee or a refugee group of some sort. I don't remember off the top of my head.
Right. So he wrote a beautiful letter to the editor. And you, as someone who has a tremendous following on social media, wanted to call attention to it, which is what you do all day. You're always on Twitter. It's amazing. I don't know when you sleep or when I work. So you wanted to bring this to the fore and say, hey guys, make sure you see this. So you refer to him as F. Murray Abraham, parentheses of Star Trek Insurrection, writes a letter to the New York Times advocating on behalf of Syria. So probably the lowest point. I mean, we love Star Trek. We even love Insurrection on the official Star Trek podcast. But
he was one of the few bright spots of what was our otherwise.
That is a good way to put it. And he definitely did rise that. I mean, Insurrection is not is not Star Trek's finest hour. It really is not. It really is not. But
if it's on TV, I will stop. I will watch it. No question about
it. Well, that's the thing about Insurrection. It's an episode.
Right.
It's just an episode that's a little bit longer. And it's a bummer because the movies usually had a much higher budget. Mm-hmm. And you were expecting a little bit more. And then Insurrection comes out and you're like,
the CGI is still very good. You know, I think the CGI is still very good, in especially, you know, in those Briar Patch scenes where the... You know, but maybe I'm wrong. I know that a lot of the, especially the TNG, there are a lot of big flaws in these films.
Yeah.
But I will just stop and, you know what, my mind will totally
when
ignore
Data's him. Singing the HMS Pinafore, oh, and that God. Is just...
Oh, my Lord. He presses one button, and the lyric, you know, Picard presses one button, and the lyrics to HMS Pinafore come up, and somehow, within 10 seconds, Worf knows the word, knows the tune, a Klingon who probably has never listened to, you know, this Gilbert and Terran Sullivan in his life.
It's great. I mean, it is wonderful. I mean, I love it all. What can I say?
Yeah, right.
You know,
right.
That's just the way it is. So you are Darth Vader. TNG is your main... Is your main thing?
Well,
right?
I'm also a big Deep Space Nine Voyager guy. I've seen all the films.
Okay.
I'm less of an Enterprise guy. I've seen a lot of the Enterprise episodes.
Yeah.
I never felt like I was watching a Star Trek series when I was watching Enterprise.
Well,
then the finale just killed me. You know,
the finale is controversial, and everyone involved in the finale has since apologized.
Right.
I mean, seriously, writers have apologized. Jonathan Frakes has apologized. Has said he didn't so much apologize, but recognized that maybe it shouldn't have been about.
Right,
him and Troy. It should have been about those characters.
Yeah,
you know?
it was. But TNG, I actually think Deep Space Nine is the best Trek series. In the latter half.
Yeah,
four through whatever.
Yeah,
because I think that Dominion War story. There were a couple of reasons. First, it was Sisko wasn't a black and white captain in the way that Picard was. Was very clear. Had very clear ethical divisions to him.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas Sisko was very, very gray area, willing to break rules if he has to.
Well, he had that line, we're not out, we're not in, what's the exact quote was, we don't live in paradise, we live out here in the hinterlands.
And to me, the best episode of Trek I've ever seen is the DS9 episode, and I'm forgetting the name of it.
In the Pale Moonlight.
Is that the one where Dukat?
Yes.
I mean, not Dukat. Garrick, thank you.
Yeah.
When Garrick assassinates the I mean, to me, that was just such a well executed. That to me was the best of Trek in many, many ways.
Well, it's interesting you refer to that as the best of Trek because this episode comes up a lot on this show and it comes up a lot at the conventions. I think it's wonderful also, but part of what makes it so great is that it breaks every Trek rule.
Yes.
Because he does not do honorable thing. He does not do the ethical thing. The ends justify the means in that episode. And he deletes the diary entry, Sisko, at the end.
And he does something
that Picard and Kirk would have never done. Now, that being said, Picard and Kirk had never been put in a situation like that before. Kirk especially, he doesn't believe in a no-win scenario, always gets out of it somehow on his guile, on his looks, on his luck. In Wrath of Khan, when he's finally put in a no-win situation, what happens? Spock sacrifices himself. That's how he gets out of it. But Sisko's got to do something, which is turn a blind eye on an immoral act and kills an innocent man for the sake of getting the Romulans into the war, a sort of a Gulf of Tonkin type incident. And it's heavy, shit, man. I mean, that's the only way to describe it. And it's totally unlike the rest of Trek. And had Gene Roddenberry been alive to watch that episode, he would have had
a conniption.
Yeah, he would have dropped that. He would have come back to life, watched it, and then dropped dead again.
But it wasn't just Sisko. What I loved about DS9, and this is not necessarily a knock on TNG, because TNG was a great series in its own right. I thought that DS9, every character had such a conflicted backstory.
Yeah.
There's a reason to watch every character, except for maybe Rom or Nog.
But until the end. But even by season seven, they were goofy.
But, Kira, the who starts off in essence as like a terrorist turned eventual Starfleet ally. And you have Odo, who's trying to find his place. you know, the storyline where he is no longer a changeling is just I think magnificent work.
Yeah.
Who is Dax? You know, and even Worf, who I think Worf, Michael Dorn's work on DS9, I think really showed. I almost feel like he was very underappreciated on TNG.
At least at first. I mean, and you know, there are.
Well,
clips.
I mean, they're right. So he's just, his role is just to get either beat up or get, or told that his ideas are stupid.
Right. Like in the abstract, it's like he's a tough guy. First of all, he's a giant. Mm-hmm. He's got the deepest voice. He's wearing the baldric. Right. I mean, he looks badass at first. And then you kind of go under the hood a little bit and like, he never really gets a chance to be badass.
No.
Because that wasn't Picard's way. It's diplomacy. It's discussion. Yeah. You know, not now, Mr. Worf. So we should attack. Not now, Mr. Worf. Right. And he was always sort of the...
In hindsight, it never even really made sense that Worf was, you know...
He shouldn't have been the head of security.
Like, it doesn't sound like Picard would look at that and be like, that's the guy I need.
Right.
A guy with a quick trigger finger. That's the guy I need, you know, running tactical for us.
Right. Yeah. Which is why the episodes in the... when they're prisoner... And in Deep Space Nine, toward the end, in the Dominion War arc, when there's that sequence when he just is in the battle royales against the Jem'Hadar, and you finally see Worf is like, you know, we've written this character as an ultimate warrior. We've never really let him do his thing because our show is about optimism and diplomacy, and it really might maybe doesn't always make right. They wrote this wide arc.
Right.
Where they allowed a little room, said, finally, after all these years. And there's that sequence of Worf just beating the hell out of one Jem'Hadar after another in like a, it's like a montage of him just like, you know, just a wrestling
match. And getting
the
grudging respect from the Jem'Hadar.
Right.
Yeah.
And that is so gratifying, even if it is not necessarily, you know, the most enlightened sequence. It's incredibly gratifying.
And then you flip that to the Cardassian side. You look at guys like Dukat, who...
Yeah.
Dukat was a very nuanced, layered character. And the same for Damar. You know, even I even found Weyoun interesting. You know?
Oh, yeah.
And in Star Trek, the characters, and I'm speaking in broad strokes, like, I don't know much about who Geordi is. Who is Geordi, really? You know? Troy, depending on, you know, like, what makes Geordi tick outside of engineering, right?
He really loves engineering. He's a dork.
Yeah.
He's just a, he's
you know,
just a
but
Mary
we all,
Sue of dorks.
But we all know people that love our jobs. Okay, but what is Geordi doing when he goes back to his quarters? Now, you had that one really creepy episode where he's, like, falls in love with someone and creates a holodeck program.
Yeah.
And that was weird.
Yeah.
But, you know, in general, I just feel like you got to know the DS9 characters on a one-on-one level a little bit more.
Yeah, it's a different type of thing. And part of it had to do with the fact that it was all on the station, on Enterprise.
Yeah,
they were going to a new planet every
week
and
that's
finding a new guest star every week,
that's
which kind of leads to what we're going to talk about.
Right.
But on DS9, it was they had the room to squat, and it spun out that way. And so, like, you had the initial X amount of main characters, but then someone like Damar, who at first, you know, like, you know, what was Damar's first big episode? Who really knows? He just sort of showed up. He was the extra guy, and then suddenly he started getting more lines, and then now he's
suddenly
somebody
you
love.
Drinking a lot. You know, you see him, suddenly you're like, okay, wait, what's going on? You're wondering, though.
Yeah.
You know, with TNG, I feel like often, though, not only did I not know that much about, let's say, Geordi or Beverly Crusher, and, you know, I wasn't that concerned with it either. You know, and not in necessarily a critical way, you know, because usually you're distracted by what's going on in the episode. Okay, how are they going to get themselves out of this, right? I just felt like I also, it just wasn't the kind of show where I think you cared that much about the backstories of the characters, you know. But maybe, I don't know, you know, but there's just something about DS9 that always grabbed me a little bit more than
TNG. I think there is a richer emotional connection with many of the DS9 characters. Like, you know, Major Keir is somebody that, like I deeply cared about by the end. Like, I was really worried that things were going to work out for her.
Sure.
You know, like, if it didn't, I was going to be really bummed. You know, like, I was going to go Kathy Bates in Misery on Ira Stephen Pear.
But you know what? You know what the other thing is? Here's why I think also why we cared more about the Kiras and Dax and all that. It's because I think the stakes seemed a little bit more... the stakes seem a little higher on DS9 in that they seem like the characters seem like in legitimate peril on an episode to episode basis.
Yeah,
and they really showed the sorrow of the Dominion War a lot. Whereas TNG, a lot of the episodes are wrapped, a lot of the storylines are wrapped up in a single episode.
Yeah, and then next week everything's fine.
Next week everything's fine, yeah. and there were very few episodes.
Yeah,
where you're actually wondering, how are they going to save this life?
Yeah.
You know, Tasha Yar's death obviously is like the lone exception.
Well, that's what's
and
so
Locutus,
funny.
Yeah, you know,
for sure.
And from my recollection,
yeah.
my recollection, you know, the Picard, the Best of Both Worlds cliffhanger was stemmed from a contract dispute more than it stemmed from, you know, like actual.
There is there is lore to that that I think it hasn't officially been figured out yet.
Right.
But yes, it was
their way of telling Picard, listen, we'll kill you off if you don't. You
right.
know.
And part of that rang for me watching it at the time because they killed Yar. Made me think that anything could go. I mean, in retrospect, not that much. I mean, toward the season 5, 6, 7, it did get a little bit more kind of under the skin a little bit, you know, with Worf's son and other, there were some other deaths and whatnot. But Tasha Yar dying in season 1 was enough of a precedent setter that when the Best of Both Worlds part 1 cliffhanger happened, and I was watching it in my grandmother's kitchen, I remember thinking, oh my God, they can't get out of that.
Right.
Because he says fire.
Right.
And then,
right.
like, what's going to happen? They're going to blow him up. There's nothing they can do. So,
right.
you know, that for me definitely had that. But I do think you're right that the DS9 had a richness that I'm not saying it didn't exist in TNG, but it was a different kind of thing. I mean, I think for TNG, maybe some of the love of the characters was just because it was archetypes, and there was a lot of a one-to-one mapping from the original series, a little bit more like, you know, Spock and Data are very similar, and, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So there, you know, there was some of that, and DS9 was its own different thing, and yeah, you're not, I mean, a lot of people do consider DS9 to be the best, and I don't disagree. I mean, I have a certain love for the original series, and, you know, I love it all, and I definitely, I mean, truth be told, I don't hold Enterprise in the same level as the others, but I do like Enterprise. I mean, the thing I could say about Enterprise is there are episodes of Enterprise that I've seen once. You know, shocking, right?
Because
an average episode of original series I've seen 25 times. But for Enterprise, there are some episodes that I've seen once, and eventually I'll see them again. I want to do a whole Enterprise rewatch at some point, but you know, it's not. It definitely isn't on the same level. But there are parts of it that I love, and certain characters that I love, and whatnot.
And Bakula wasn't bad.
Oh, he's great. Yeah.
Bakula, I mean, that was one of the few good decisions that show made. Bakula is Captain.
He's dynamite. I love that character, and I love Trip Tucker a lot. He's one of my favorites, and, you know, T'Pol, Shran. I love Shran. I love all those guys. So, but we were, when we were talking earlier about, you know, what should the focus of this episode be, now that we've established your love of Trek, and how Trek figured in. How did Trek figure in on the campaign trail at all?
Oh, man. Well, for one thing.
And you were on the trail for
almost 2 years.
Yeah.
On the road full time.
Now,
went to more than 40 states, hundreds of rallies with Trump.
Yeah. And when you got assigned to Trump, so to speak, you were working at the time for CBS. Was that luck of the draw? Like, you could have been assigned to Scott Walker or Cruz?
Well, so basically, there's about, each network has about 6 campaign embeds, give or take.
Yeah. I mean,
it varies from network to network. And each of us were assigned four candidates, give or take. And I was assigned Marco Rubio, Rand Paul, Lindsey Graham. And then, kind of as a throwaway, this is before Trump had announced, we'll give you Trump because you're going to be so busy with Rand Paul and Marco Rubio that we'll give you someone who's probably not even going to run.
That's like the big bopper getting on that plane.
And I was like, you know, I look at the, you know, Trump, now we're going to cover that guy.
Yeah.
You know, and I was, and within, you know, a month of him running, you know, I was out there, you know, give or take.
Yeah.
And it was clear to me early on that this was not a run-of-the-mill campaign.
Sure.
Now, I would be lying if I thought at any point he was going to become president. No, but I didn't think he was the fringe that a lot of people thought. And in terms of how Trek factored in, I always think there are two things. First of all, you have very little free time on the trail.
Yeah.
And when you do, you're always checking your phone. You're always like, because you know, you never know, Trump could tweet, and it's just a constantly very fast moving news cycle.
And you're still tasked to Rubio, who was in the game for a while.
Yeah, right. You absolutely, yeah. So there's that too.
Yeah.
But for me, I would value being in my hotel room, getting back at midnight, 1 a.m, and having an hour where I could just pop on my favorite DS9 episode. And just unplug and not check my phone for anything.
Wow.
That was more important to me than an hour of sleep. Because you just go crazy otherwise.
Sure, yeah.
And then the other thing I always think about is I look at Gene Roddenberry's vision for the future. And I go, my God, what would he think of a Trump candidacy? You know, and I don't know. Yeah. I would be curious if he would look at, you know, Donald Trump as a step back, a step forward. I don't know, and I wonder. I think about this idealistic vision he has had for the future, and I wonder how far he thinks we're from that, you know. And I would sometimes think about that because just even everything from like whether it's the capitalism aspect of it, the you know, the welcoming of people of color and, you know, all that stuff, you know, I that was something that I would think about sometime.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's pretty much where kind of Star Trek kind of factored in. I just think about what a strange world Gene Roddenberry thinks our future is, you know?
Right, we're not quite there yet, but I think, you know, he probably...
But it doesn't seem like, my point, yeah. let me like crystallize that. It doesn't seem like, you know, this is a world or a country that is headed for harmony in the way that Gene Roddenberry sees
yeah.
it.
Yeah, well, no, dude, you got to get out of, what's the expression? Before you can get to heaven, you got to get through hell or something mm-hmm, like that, mm-hmm. you know, you got to...
Yeah.
There's that. That's right. One optimistic thing. I mean, maybe he would have figured that someone would come, like, you know, whenever Kirk would face a real tough obstacle or like, you know, there would be like a really tough robot or computer he would face, he would talk logic to it and it would explode.
Yeah,
so
right.
maybe that is what's coming up next.
Sure.
So,
yeah.
But that's TOS. So TNG, we were talking about Next Generation, how many great guest stars and just players who were not recurring characters. And we figured we would come in, each of us, with three of our favorite. And I am going, so we'll do bronze, silver, and gold.
Sure, okay.
And I'm going to ask you to go first, since you're the guest.
Okay, so I hope I'm not violating here. So I did this, there are two things here. I did mine as people... that appeared once.
Yes.
Did not appear again. And people that would have, so in as in, I would love to see, I really wish we saw them again.
Okay.
I did not include people that appeared once that were perfect in that one time that I didn't want to see again because it would have ruined it. So for example, I did not include, let's say, Spock, who appeared only in Unification, because the what made that episode so great is that we hadn't, it was Spock.
Yeah.
I didn't want him to become a recurring role on TNG. I wanted the lore of Spock to remain, which is why it killed me that Spock appeared again in the sequel to the reboot. It was wonderful to see him in the 2009 reboot. Yep. And because I remember seeing both in theaters, okay? And I remember when he first appeared on screen in 2009 Star Trek, the theater goes crazy when he appears in that cave. The second time, I was like, really? We're doing this again?
Yeah.
You know, part of what, you know, the nostalgic aspect of it was just so great. And that's why, so I didn't include someone like Spock or Scotty, Jimmy Doohan as Scotty. Like, you know, I just thought he was perfect in that one episode.
Right. Relics, you're talking about season 6.
Right. And, or Sarek, you know, those guys. Because I just thought you sprinkle those in. You don't want to think. So I will do bronze, I guess, silver and gold. And my bronze is, first one is, I'm going to pronounce this wrong, but Liz Dennehy, who played Lieutenant Commander Shelby in The Best of Both Worlds.
Well, that's funny you should put that, because she was one of my many that ended up being tied for fourth place.
Oh, is that right?
So I'm glad you brought her up.
Here's why she's notable. If you think about when Best of Both Worlds aired, it was at a time when Star Trek didn't have, you know, a lot of strong commander women on the show. You had Admiral
Nechayev, right. And she was always a stick in the mud.
Right. And yeah. Here's a woman that comes along, clearly competent.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Clearly will not take any, you know, will not take guff from anybody.
Not even the very handsome Will Riker can get her to change her mind.
Right. But also very good at what she does. She wasn't like someone who was, you know, arrogant without having cause to be. She knew what she was doing.
Yeah.
And it really bummed me out we never saw her again. Did she become captain? What happened to her?
She's off exploring the Borg. She's the Borg.
You know, but
whisperer,
here's someone who probably saved Earth with, you know, in those two episodes, and we never heard from her again.
Yeah.
That really bummed me out because she was such a strong character. You know, what did Picard do after? I hope he wrote her a nice recommendation. You know, I just thought that was that's a role that I thought should have been a recurring role.
Interesting. And what's also interesting is you mentioned before that, you know, there was that tease at the end of part one in that cliffhanger that Picard was going to die, Patrick Stewart was going to be written off the show, and the new dynamic of Jonathan Frakes and Elizabeth Dennehy as Riker mm-hmm. and Shelby, that would have been great.
Yeah.
That would have been great.
Yeah, and also that episode showed a lot of growth for Jonathan Frakes as
yeah.
well.
Yeah,
you know, Frakes, you know, you see him truly vulnerable. You see him as, you know, potentially the next captain.
Yeah.
You know, and you could clearly, I think Frakes played this very well in that you clearly see he's playing in that he's fronting, that he's very confident, but you can tell he's not sure of himself.
Oh, he's flipping out. Yeah. You know? On and the inside, I, but he's I thought, driving him crazy.
And
yeah.
I thought he really, as an actor, played that off really well. Whereas Shelby, and I think this is true to the character, Shelby was legitimately sure of herself.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
she had every confidence yeah, in herself, you know, in a way that Riker didn't.
She's presented sort of as a bad guy, but she's not. Like, she's a foil. Mm-hmm. She's not a villain, you know? She's not evil, but she's
yeah.
a foil. And, you know, that dynamic gets played again in Chain of Command when Ronnie Cox's character...
The Admiral. I forget his name now, too, but yeah, he was excellent,
that's
too.
That's how I roll. As
yeah. But we'll get to Chain of Command in a little bit.
Really? Because I have... All right. Do you want me to do my number?
Yeah. Give me your
Jellicoe,
bronze.
Captain Edward Jellicoe.
Jellicoe, that's right.
And by the way, Shelby, I'm 99% certain, shows up in the books afterwards, right?
Oh, I mean, is that right?
Oh, she has to.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
She's in a zillion... She ends up in the Peter David Mackenzie Calhoun books.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So what happens to her? Do we know?
No, I don't know. I personally don't know, but she's in a lot of... She ends up in the New Frontier books that Peter David wrote under Mackenzie Calhoun, which is hardcore, deep...
that's a deep
expanded. She, at some point, is his first officer. That does not surprise me at all. Okay.
Riker's first officer.
No, no. The New Frontier books was a series that Peter David wrote that had no... It was its own
yeah.
ship, mm-hmm. and it. I haven't read too much of it, but it pops up in some of the other expanded
okay.
Star Trek novels, okay. which is the next level on the next campaign. You're going to start reading the Star Trek novels.
Okay, no, I read a couple of Shatner's.
The Shatterverse, where he comes back to life.
They
have his memory in the Matrix or something.
Man. I mean, with the way they killed him off, can you blame him?
Yeah, no, I cannot. I cannot.
Okay, so that Shelby gets... Oh, do you want to do your bronze?
Here's my bronze. You ready?
Please.
I'm going to get reamed for this because
this is a
a Wesley Crusher specific episode,
mm-hmm.
which already has people.
Oh, no.
And it's Wesley's love interest.
Oh, no.
But it's not even Robin Loeffler.
Are we talking about... Wait, which episode is
I'm
this?
I'm talking about the episode The Dauphin.
Fresh my memory.
That is the one where it's early on. It's young Wesley.
Okay.
And there's the young girl. She's actress was actually 27, but she's playing 15.
Yeah.
And she's actually a leader who's going to a planet to try and bring peace and harmony.
Yes, I do remember
that. People hate this episode. She's so good.
She was a young leader of two warring factions.
Warring factions. There was a planet that was one was in all darkness and one was in all light. And so she's raised elsewhere. And the actress that plays her is a woman by the name of, I have it written down. Her name is Jamie Hubbard.
Okay.
And she never really did much else.
Right.
Right now, she's actually living in Los Angeles. She works as a psychotherapist. And
interesting.
And her email address and her phone number is right there if you want to. She has like marriage counseling and whatnot. And she looks fantastic. So the deal with this episode, which I love. So Jamie Hubbard, she was 27 when she did this. And she's the love interest of... flirty love interest. She's definitely supposed to be a little bit older than Wes.
Right.
But like a year or two. Will Wheaton was 17 at the time, but he's kind of playing 15, 16. You know, 16 and a half, 16 and three quarters. And she is, you know, she's got this, her shtick is she's got this mile wide grin. And when you first see her, what you later learn is that she's been sort of held almost like she's being groomed to be this leader, and all she wants to be is to explore, to have a life of her own, to be a child, to be free, and she's fascinated and everything, and she's brilliant.
Yep.
So the reason why Wesley loves her is because she's beautiful and smiles a lot. Yeah, she's like his age. She knows everything about everything, which is exciting for his big brain also.
Yep.
And we later learn she can transform into like giant bug beasts. And then when you see her, her natural form is not as this smiley girl. She's like a beam of light. But it's the best scene, and it's so geeky and dorkily romantic, is when they first meet. Her name is Salia. And they beam her aboard, and I'm going to read it word for word, right? So Picard is there, and he's welcoming her, and she's got also her granny, her governess. And the governess, by the way, transforms also. She's like a little, she's like a little small bug beast, then she's a giant bug beast. And then for a little while, she transforms into an attractive young woman who's played by Madchen Amick of Twin Peaks fame. Just for like one scene. It's like, oh, who's this other girl who's like kind of hot? What's going on? So here's the thing. Picard is walking her through the corridor, and he's bumbling, oh, we've got your quarter set up, blah, 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 blah. And Wesley's just there, and his mouth is just kind of like open, like, oh, who is this girl? She's so beautiful. And she does a big close-up on her, and she kind of leaps over to, bounds over to him with excitement, and she goes, oh, she's gasping. She goes, that's a superconducting magnet, isn't it? And he says, yes, it's an SCM model. How did you know that? Study for the last 16 years. It's all I could do. And she's like, please. And so like she's just like a sexy, smart science chick, you know? Right. But she plays it really, really well. It's so sweet. It's not lewd or lascivious or leering at all, I don't think. It's just such a sweet thing. And every scene between the two of them, it just brings me such joy. I mean, I guess I sort of had a, you know, I projected myself into Wesley a little bit when I was a kid.
Sure.
I mean,
sure.
What can I say?
Here's what Wesley Crusher has been dissected at length by TNG fans going back. However, I just think that he was such a misused character. Not a bad one.
Mm.
Just put in... I don't think Will Wheaton was put in a particularly good position to succeed in that role.
That is a very fair point, because he was either just like a dopey kid or a super genius and nowhere in between.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I think that's right. There was just no nuance to him.
Yeah.
And, you know, you didn't get to see him... I can't think of a single time where I was like... Wow, this is a good use of Wesley, you know. Like I just can't think like and that, by the way, extended all the way to his lone appearance in Nemesis, in the TNG movies.
Right.
His one scene got cut,
right.
And then that one scene is when he's hitting on a woman, which no one would hit on a woman, and he's a full grown adult. It was just, I mean, come on.
Well, I mean, I hate to say it, but like the best thing. The coolest thing that Wesley ever did was leave, to go with the Traveler and be some pan-dimensional, you know, brilliant traveler of some sort.
Right.
Like, that's the coolest thing about his character was that he split. He's like, Starfleet, I'm out of here.
Right.
I don't know. He's got some good moments. The first duty episode where he's covering up for his friends. And
yes, you know what? Duncan McNeil?
Robert Duncan McNeil.
He plays, not... Tom Paris at the time. But yes, that was a very good episode. But frankly, less to do with Wesley and more to do with Robert Duncan. Yeah. Speaking of great guest stars.
And it's great of its great moment is when Picard is just ripping him to shreds when he's screaming at your first duty is to the truth. You know, that scene is just amazing. So Saleha is my bronze medal. That's I gotta be honest, and I think of her fondly, and in a and now that I am an old man and she's still 15 in my eyes. In my mind and in my heart, I think of her in an avuncular way. You know, I admire her and encourage her to be the weirdo nerd science girl slash UN Secretary General of whatever planet she's going to.
Right.
You know, it's
so just to circle back on the Wesley thing in 1 second is something I have to think about when it comes to when I used to like quote unquote as a kid play Star Trek, right, and dress up and pretend I was a Starfleet captain, you know, and I would have, you know, I would take a joystick, you know, and pretend I was like a pilot in my room, and you know, all the characters on Star Trek, whether it was Riker or, you know, Picard or Sisko, or they made being into sci-fi, being into space cool. It felt cool to me.
Yeah.
Wesley Crusher was the one guy who I was like, ugh, that guy's ruining this for me. You know, that's and that's being grossly unfair to Will Wheaton, who I like very much. We actually had a very very fun Twitter exchange.
Yes, you did.
And one of my favorite. But I think that given better direction, given better writing for his character, I think he, you know, you could see it because you could see the potential there.
Yeah.
You know,
and the costuming. I mean, that sweater is just, you know, now it's a kitsch thing, but I mean, it's like Jar Jar, you know, it's like one of those, it's, you know, you got to just love it. But it is, it, some people have never quite gotten to that part where they just at this point embrace it. But he
wasn't the worst Star Trek kid, though. Jake Sisko takes the worst Star Trek kid.
Come on. How can you say that?
No.
His mother died of Wolf 359. How can you say that?
I know, but in terms of...
Is that just because of...
There's not a character that I loathe or skip past scenes more than Jake Sisko.
Really?
Yeah. Name me a single compelling episode that has Jake Sisko as a
Yarmuk sauce. Self-sealing stem bolts.
I'm trying to refresh my memory.
That's when he and young Nog are trying to...
Even Nog, I actually like Nog more than Jake Sisko. Nog to me was kind of interesting. Here's a guy that is brought up in a culture that is supposed to be purely just about capitalism, and he goes, "No, screw that! I want to join Starfleet."
Yeah, no, he's great.
And with no real discernible, his discernible skill is like making money. That's and like, okay, go to Starfleet, man.
Yeah.
Jake Sisko was a horrible journalist who what.
He went to one. He was embedded once in a battle, and he kind of flipped out.
I keep trying to remember that.
Yeah, he witnessed some sort of ambush. He was embedded once, and then he had PTSD as a result.
Oh, okay. I just remember him like, you know, him taking censorship lying down because I mean, come on, man. It's like 20, whatever the year is, and you're like, come on, man. I think Star Trek just doesn't do kids well.
Maybe that's fair.
You know, they just don't do kids well. But even as Jake Sisko got older, you know, I always was...
Right,
and
then they tried to avoid it. They made, you know, Kes was a kid. I mean, she was six years
actually,
old.
I actually thought Kes was an excellent character.
I like Kes, too. A lot of people didn't.
I liked Kes a lot. I found her to be very compelling.
I thought she was intriguing, and it was there was sort of that weird... Like, there's that thing, like, with Dax, you know, I mean, she's, you know, you see her and you look at it's Terry Farrell, but then Sisko's calling her old man, and you're like, oh, yeah, she's lived these seven other lives.
Mm-hmm.
You look at Kes, she's 6 years old, but Jennifer Lean was a grown woman, and it's a little bit of a, you got to readjust your thinking a little bit.
But Kes is one of the few characters, and I'll add Neelix to this, I'll add Chakotay, Seven of Nine, where I was like... In that same DS9 vein where I'm like, wow, I'm legitimately interested in what is going on there.
Yeah.
You know, like, how did you get here and why and what's going on? Not as much with, like, you know, the Harry Kims and the Tom Paris.
Because they were more traditional.
Yeah.
Traditional roles.
Yeah.
You know, the funny thing about Seven of Nine and Jerry Ryan is that she
had a miserable time on the show, if I recall.
Well, yeah, she the costuming, and she and Mulgrew didn't get along at the time. Now they do.
Is that right? So they get along fine now.
There were a little sparks between the two of them. Yeah. Her performance, Jeri Ryan was to a degree a victim of the least belligerent form of prejudice there is, which is that she was so beautiful that people didn't take her seriously. You know, she was such a sex symbol, which is by conventional standards, she's a you know, out of a 10, she's a 3,000. I mean, she's a very conventional beauty put in a very lascivious outfit, and a lot of people just wrote her off and say, "Oh, the show's down in the ratings. They need some boobs on the screen."
Mm.
And the truth of the matter is, there was a degree of truth to that. But her performance is really, really nuanced and very funny. I mean, her comic timing is hilarious.
Yes.
And, you know, the character was...
But also, when she is at her most agonized...
Yeah.
My eyes were glued to the screen.
Yeah,
you know, when she... Especially those early episodes, when she's first introduced, because it's... You know, you kind of wish that, what's that famous TNG episode with Hugh? I think it's just called Hugh. I thought, I was like, wow, I don't want this to be just an episode long. And here comes Jeri Ryan, kind of the embodiment of that, of that episode, one of the best episodes of TNG.
Mm-hmm.
But she really put a lot of nuance and a lot of depth into that run. I really thought so.
And the transition was good, and then it became, you know, every Trek has always had the outsider trying to get in, which is very important for fans, because a lot of the fans of Star Trek historically have been, you know, they didn't quite fit in, so they identified with Spock, then they identified with Data, and on Voyager, and then on DS9 they identified with Odo. And on Data, they didn't in Voyager, they didn't really have that yet. Maybe Kes was supposed to be that.
That's a good point. And I guess the closest would be, like, you know, before Kes and I guess Neelix, you know.
Yeah, but he's such a gregarious, you know, he wasn't shy, right?
Yeah,
I mean,
Tuvok.
No, because he was part of the crew.
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
And he was Janeway's.
Same for Torres and Chakotay.
Yeah.
I kind of wish early on I felt like they resolved the Maquis being on the ship of a...
Yeah.
I felt like they resolved that very... Like, there was a
little pat, maybe? Kind of happened.
Yeah, just kind of like...
Let's put this, if you started watching Voyager in season 3, they, like, never mentioned it anymore.
That's right.
Like, you would never know that they were at war at the beginning,
right.
You know?
That's
it just kind of went...
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Welcome back to Engage.
Engage.
The official Star Trek podcast with your host, Jordan Hoffman.
You are, after all, irrational.
So who's your silver medal
for
this? Yeah.
All right, I'm going to mispronounce. It's been a long time since I've seen this episode.
Yeah.
But I think it is one of the strongest episodes of TNG. And it is an episode called... I guess she's in two episodes, actually. The episodes are called The Emissary and Reunion. It is Susie Plaxen.
Oh, yeah.
As Ambassador... How do I pronounce this? Kalar. Kalar. Okay.
Kalar,
yeah, that's right. Kalar.
Yeah.
And I remember the first episode she shows up. And I'm like, wait a minute, what? Worf has a love interest, and he has a this is the mother of his son.
Right.
Then they eventually kill her off, and you're like, wait a minute, I want to know more about this relationship.
Yeah, yeah.
Because this is a dignity that TNG did not allow Worf very often.
Mm.
This is something that they did not. This is not room that. This room they allowed Michael Dorn to explore in DS9, but at that time, this is something that gave Worf a level of depth that he had previously not had. That's A. B, a very strong performance.
Yeah.
One of the few, you know, I think, women that could play Klingon and match Michael Dorn note for note.
Right, right, right.
You know, yeah. Because I think playing a Klingon is a challenging thing.
Right, and she was also a very cerebral Klingon, right?
Yes.
She was like a tactician.
Right. It wasn't like she was like the Duras sisters, where it was like, you know, all bark, all bite. She was like, you know, contemplative. She was a contemplative Klingon.
Yeah.
But aside from the power of the performance itself, and aside from the nuance it gave Worf, I just thought I wanted to know more about it.
Yeah.
See, it was a good enough performance that you want to know more.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that. Well, that's the first rule of show business. Always leave me wanting more. It's funny that, so Susie Plaxton, by the way, she's played three characters on Star Trek. She was on the original, first season of TNG, she was the nurse, the Vulcan nurse called, Saylar, I think. Or
okay.
You would recognize her. And then she was on Voyager. She was the female Q.
Oh.
Yeah, she didn't wear any makeup for that.
Oh,
but
interesting.
So, but dig this. So she's always at the conventions, right?
Right.
She's fan favorite.
Sure,
she's,
sure.
She mixes it up with the fans. She's very funny. Sometimes she'll just go, like at the convention, like where people are just having lunch. You know, there's like the extra room where people are just having a sandwich.
Sure.
She'll just go around and shake hands, you know?
Yeah.
So one of the shticks that she's been doing for the last few years is a non-canonical show that she puts on where she dresses herself in... like on stage, she'll appear as Susie, and then she will become Kalar. She'll put the makeup on, and she will commune with Kalar and fill you in on what she's been up to. Like,
wow.
You know, she felt that she, like you said, she died too soon, and explains her, you know, her travels in the underworld or whatever.
Right.
So
the performances are so good that it pulls it off. But in the end of that, when she gets killed off, Worf immediately rushes to a Klingon bird of prey or whatever, and then stabs Duras. And for me, I'm like, okay, here's a woman that makes Worf do this. Why? My God, I wish that, you know, this is a big alliance shifting moment in the show, and it happened because of a character we've seen once.
Right, right, right.
And so for me, this is a great example. Unlike Spock, who I didn't want to see anymore because of the lore, this is a great example of a character where the performance was so good that the story ends up being underserved as a result.
Mm.
You know, and so it was. And then the weird thing is, Worf never suffered any consequences as a result. Right? He just I think got like the equivalent of demerit on his record. You know,
they kind of brushed it under the rug.
He murdered him.
Right.
That was murder.
Well, circumstances.
I mean, you can't just. He wasn't tried in court. He was a Federation officer that just murdered someone.
Well, you know...
And I don't even know if it was actually established beyond a reasonable doubt that it was Duras. We know it was... You know it was Duras. I know it was Duras. But, like, in terms of... If that happened today...
Oh, yeah.
That's murder! Worf is guilty of murder! Like, it just struck... And Duras, who is this... powerful figure in the Klingon Empire. My guess is, in the real world, some allies somewhere are like, wait a minute, Worf murdered our guy.
Well,
we have some questions.
But the thing is, the power vacuum was then filled with people that were grateful.
Grateful for Gowron?
Yeah. At the time,
But I'm sure, but Duras still had his allies, right? His powerful allies. Because I don't think you rise up and get that many people behind you without having genuine support.
Yeah,
it's not like Duras is like coercing all the support.
Yeah.
You know, but I don't know.
It wasn't a situation where finally he was gone. They're like, "Yay, we're free. We don't have to listen to that guy anymore."
Right. It's not like it's not like Worf liberated these people.
Right. Right.
You know?
Right.
But my point. But here's my point, though. My point is. It's worth exploring all that, and part of what made it worth exploring is that the guest performance was
came
so
from
strong.
The performance, yeah. Well, yeah. I mean,
it was a wonderful episode. I actually think that storyline, if could have been fleshed out and made into an excellent TNG movie.
Yeah,
you know,
a Worf movie would have been great. Sure,
you know,
but it was sort of, it did leave a legacy in that Alexander would be around, so when you would see him, you would remember her to a degree.
Mm.
So maybe, you know, unlike say Picard's girlfriend Vash, who was only in two episodes but left
who
a real.
Who was Vash again?
The sort of the archaeologist.
Oh,
the
from
Indiana Jones.
Did they meet on Risa?
They met on Risa. Yeah. So she was a lot of fun. So let me tell you what my silver medal was. And this, I have a hunch it's going to be on your number one then, because we referenced it.
Yeah.
Was from the episode Chain of Command, Goal Madrid.
Yeah, that's mine. Yeah,
that's your number one.
That's my
okay.
goal. Yeah.
So you know what? Hey, Brian, we have an audio cue. Let's hear about a minute of David Warner's performance from Chain of Command.
When children learn to devalue others, they can devalue anyone, including their parents.
What a blind, narrow view you have. What an arrogant man you are. What do you know of Cardassian history?
I know that once you were a peaceful people, with a rich spiritual life.
And what did peace and spirituality get us? People starved by the millions. Bodies went unburied. Disease was rampant. Suffering was unimaginable.
Since the military took over, hundreds of thousands more have died.
But we are feeding the people. We acquired territory during the wars. We developed new resources. We initiated a rebuilding program. We have mandated agricultural programs. That is what the military has done for Cardassia. And because of that, my daughter will never worry about going hungry.
Whoa.
Her belly may be full.
Wait.
But her spirit will be empty.
Belly may be full, but her spirit may be empty. Ah, there it is. He smacks him. My God.
Oh, what a performance.
It really is terrific. It's the best. So David Warner, first of all, this was his second Star Trek appearance. Mm. He was in the quite sometimes correctly maligned Star Trek V. He was on Nimbus 3. He was the humanoid.
Oh.
Yeah, he was that guy. He had a small part in Star Trek V with the Romulan gal and the Klingon dude. Not Klingon, Vulcan.
Mate.
And I knew him from Tron.
Tron? You know,
yeah, he's Sark from Tron.
Oh, okay. I mean, it's been a long time since
he's the
Tron.
Bad guy.
Yeah, sure.
Brian, you just made it. Is that where you recognize that voice from?
Yeah, I'm like, where do I know that from? And that's absolutely it.
It's Sark from Tron. And then, of course, he did a zillion years of theater in Britain,
yes.
Which, and so he and Patrick Stewart knew one another, and the scene where Madrid is torturing him, and Patrick Stewart, they closed the set and said, "I will do this scene naked," knowing that they weren't going to show nudity on TV, but he felt that it would be good for the character, and he respected Warner enough to felt that it would be the right thing to do.
Oh, that's interesting.
So when he's beating the shit out of Picard, he is a naked captain.
Here's what I love about that scene,
yeah.
And you hear it there, is that I think when an actor initially sees those lines and see, okay, I'm a villain, your temptation is to overdo it.
Yeah.
And kind of yell and kind of like, you know, be ham-fisted about it.
Yeah, Montalbán and Khan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which had its own,
sure.
You know. I mean, Ricardo Montalbán had his own
the whole different style.
Yeah,
you know, whole different style.
But he's so calm that you could. It almost makes it more vicious.
It's terrifying.
It almost makes it like he is. This man is a sociopath. Like, he's so casual in his brutality.
Yeah.
You know, that's what makes that. And the reason this is, and I, as I qualified at the beginning, is like, this is a character I want to see more of. Because if I recall, and tell me if I'm wrong here, and again, because it's been a while since I've seen this episode, at the end of the episode, Captain Jellico, Admiral Jellico does his thing. They pull, you know, he's doing the There Are Four Lights thing.
Yeah.
They just kind of like pull him out.
Yeah.
And then that's it.
No, he's not killed or anything.
Not killed. Like, yeah. We don't know what happened to him. This guy was put in charge of interrogating the Federation's probably in the top five of most important people.
Right, yeah.
And then, you know, is we just never hear from him
back
again.
To work Monday morning.
And I would love, because you could just see the potential. Now, I understand this guy's a well-known actor. You know, you probably don't have access to him, you know. But this guy has the potential to probably be the best villain in TNG.
Yeah.
You know, well, like, better than Admiral Sela, probably. No, and I liked the Admiral Sela storyline.
Yeah.
You know, better than Tomalak.
Yeah.
You know, Tomalak, who almost seemed at times cartoonish, Tom Long's a good example who I actually, you know, there are moments of Tom Long where I'm like, very, this is very good. But Tom Long at times was cartoonish in his villainry, you know, where it was just like, you can't take him seriously. And you could see him and Picard not playing well off each other as a result. This was clearly like not that.
Yeah, they were equals. I mean, yeah. because they were both so smart, right? I mean, mm-hmm. Picard is an incredibly intelligent man, and Madred is, he knows exactly what his place is. I mean, it's the banality of evil is what it
yes.
is. It's that he's got a job to do, which is to be the torturer and to get the codes. And when if his daughter is going to come by,
yeah, get very casual,
you know,
because
it's his office hours. So daughter's going to come by, and he's going to talk to her, and let her see the wounded prisoner, because that's just what he does, and that's just the society.
Take your daughter to work day.
His daughter to work day. And what's interesting is that this episode aired in December of 1992, mm-hmm. so before DS9 started. It was not the first encounter with the Cardassians, but it was one of the first. And it really helped establish who they were and what they were all about, which is they had these intricacies. They were fascist. They were ends justify the means, but they had this weird quirk about family. And they thought that they were doing the right thing. I mean, they thought that their empire was for the best. I mean, in that quote we heard, you know, when the military took over, our children aren't hungry anymore. So they were not just like chaotic evil, right?
It wasn't like the Borg, right?
No, yeah, exactly. Right, yeah, it was a totally different enemy from the Borg. And then let's just not forget, everybody they cast as a Cardassian was always an imposing figure, very tall, sort of kind of the gaunt looking face. And yes. the costume that he's wearing yes. is this sort of black, it comes to a point. It's like an upside down triangle, you know, very.
Were
you
there
know, imposing.
Any prominent female Cardassian guest spots in either DS9 or in TNG? Dukat's daughter is the one I can think
yeah,
of.
Yeah, but she was half...
Right, she was half Bajoran.
Yeah.
Right?
No. No, you mainly see the men.
I guess that's right. Not even in a support capacity, right? Like, not even, like, even on the crew.
Well, there was the one where they did, like, an undercover thing, right? But let's see what the internet has to say. I mean, yeah, they do show up. Mm-hmm. But, no, there wasn't, like, unlike the Duras sisters, for example.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
with the Klingons and... You know, other, you know, Moogie on Ferengi, you know, Ferenginar.
Right.
No, you didn't have a really important. I mean, the daughter. She was the big. Zial was the biggie, and she was an interesting character because she was.
Zial's a great example, by the way, of a character that was, I thought, perfectly fleshed out. Didn't see her too often. Didn't not see her.
Yeah.
I thought she was an essential character to what made DS9 such a great show.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't about Zial per se. It was about her relationship with Garak, Kira, and Gul Dukat.
Yeah.
And I thought...
And what she represented in this war.
She represented something different to each of those three.
Yeah.
You know, depending on... And depending on who she was talking to. You know, and I just thought that was such an interesting... It's a brilliant piece of writing.
Yeah.
You know, it really was.
Yeah, and something that didn't come until later on in the series. You know, I forget what season, but like... Didn't show up until later, had one episode, went away for a little while, then would come back, then would maybe get mentioned in the line of dialogue, but you didn't see her. You know, they did it right. So, listen, we're wrapping up here. So your, just to recap, your bronze was...
Now I'm already forgetting. Let me pull it up here. It was... where'd you go? Okay, Elizabeth Dennehy as Lieutenant...
Right, that's Brian Dennehy's daughter, by the way. Yeah.
Oh.
I wouldn't lie about Brian Dennehy on the show. So Shelby was your bronze. My bronze was the Dauphin.
Right.
whatever her name was. What was the actress's name? Because you can Google her. You can call. If you live in L.A., you can tell her your woes. And then my silver was Gul Madred, which was your... And your silver was...
Susie Plaxton.
Kalar.
Yeah.
Your gold was Gul Madred, and my gold was...
Please.
Wait, let's get a drum roll here. Let's at least get a red alert. Okay. My favorite guy, I got to be honest, it's Berlinghoff Rasmussen, Matt Frewer's character from the episode A Matter of Time, which is the episode when they get a visitor from the future comes to the Enterprise, and Picard and everybody else on board thinks that he knows what's going on, and he's there as a historian to watch an important day on the episode.
Right, right, right.
When really he's bullshitting everybody.
Oh, yes, that's he's right. There yes, to yes, steal yes, stuff. Yes.
That third act twist was my favorite. And I was, as a kid, a big fan of Max Headroom, which you're a little younger than I am. Do you know who Max Headroom is?
I don't.
Is? Do you know what? I'm going to. Brian, can we show a picture of Max Headroom?
Yes, give me one.
Brian, do you know who Max Headroom is?
Yes, I do.
All right. Well, you're a bigger nerd than that's okay. But you're gonna know the face. You've seen that image before, right?
I don't. I'm telling you, I'm embarrassed.
Well, no, don't be embarrassed. This is where you learn things. Is on.
Yeah. No, tell me.
If you were around in the 1980s, and I was a little kid, you're a little. I don't know how old you are, but you're
I'm
29.
Kid.
You're 29. You're a nice chunk younger than I am. Not significantly that we can't talk to one another, but a little bit. So, Max Headroom was a ubiquitous character that started out in Britain. He was an American actor, Matt Frewer.
Yeah.
But it was a British show where it was on the British version of MTV, which wasn't called MTV. He was a video... It started off as a VJ, but he was a fake character. He was a make-believe computer simulation, and they made him look like that.
Oh my
and
gosh.
Then he became popular, so they kind of retconned a science fiction show that had sort of a Brazil 1984 vibe to it about his... origin, and it was a sci-fi show, and it was a low budget Blade Runner look in like 86, 87 or whatever, and he was really, really popular for a minute and a half, and then he wasn't popular again.
Right, right.
He also was the spokesperson for, I want to say, New Coke, which shows you how, because New Coke
correct.
Was like the world's biggest flop in marketing. Right. So he was the New Coke spokesperson. And then he would appear like in videos a lot. And like the band The Art of Noise would sample him.
Yeah, right.
So in like the year 1987, he was everywhere. And then by the year 1988 came, he was done. You couldn't find him anywhere.
Sure, sure.
But Matt Frewer is a character actor. He shows up in a lot of things. He still works to this day. He was in the BFG, the Spielberg movie from last year.
Oh, wow, okay.
He shows up a lot. So he was perfect because he had that kind of sarcastic, kind of flat Midwestern kind of punk-ass vibe. And for most of the show, you think that he's this future genius, but really he's just a rogue. He's a thief. And you didn't have too many of those characters on TNG. You had Harry Mudd in the original series, and then you had Neelix in Voyager. But on TNG, you didn't have too much of that. And he has one of my favorite moments in all of Star Trek, which is when things are really hitting the fan. And so what happens... Oh, so the real thing it's all about is whether... or not Picard is going to violate the Prime Directive, because he's trying to avoid some sort of catastrophe, right? And if Picard knew what was going to happen, if he could understand the predestination of the thing,
right,
he could make the right choice. And he knows that that's unethical because it violates the Prime Directive and you shouldn't monkey with the timeline. But when his back's against the wall, Picard's like, I have to use this hand that's been dealt to me. You know, I have to, if I have the opportunity to ask somebody what to do, this observer from the future on this historic event, he's going to do it. Now, at this point in the story, Picard really thinks that he's from the future. And he does. He says, I need to know. I need to use every tool in my toolbox.
Yeah.
And you are a tool. And he doesn't give him the answer. And he gives him the pep talk about follow your instincts and the Prime Directive. Really, he's just bullshitting him. So anyway, the moment is, I'll just read a little bit of dialogue here. So when everything's hitting the fan, warp power has been restored, everybody's yelling at each other, LaForge and Worf and blah, blah, blah. And LaForge says on the view screen, excuse me, Captain, but I can be a lot more help down here, meaning in the engineering room. We're going to have to compensate for density variations right up to the last second. Data says, Dr. Moseley's computers can accomplish the same task, but Geordi will be better able to anticipate unexpected variances. Mr. LaForge, you know better than anyone there's no guarantee this will all work. If this fails, and he says, no guarantee it's going to fail, Captain. I love this dramatic reading. I've never done this on the show before.
Yeah, right.
I'd like your permission to remain here on the surface. Picard says, permission granted. And then Rasmussen, he raises his eyebrow and he goes, LaForge remained below. And it was like he was narrating a documentary.
Yeah, right,
you know,
right,
it's just
right.
This great little moment, just such great writing. And who wrote this episode, A Matter of Time? That one was written by Rick Berman. Of course it was written by Rick Berman. So there you go. He is my favorite one-shot. He is a guy that I want to know more about.
Right.
I want to have comic books based on Rasmussen, and I want to see him show up again somehow in some new form. So that's
ultimate,
my three.
Ultimate confidence guy, though.
Yeah, he's terrific.
What a great
hook he's got. I'm from the future. Because you wouldn't believe that here.
No.
If somebody showed up at your office at the New York Times and said, I'm from the future, I'm just going to hang out. You'd be like, security.
Yeah, right.
But on the Enterprise, if somebody shows up and says, I'm from the future, like, oh, yeah, sure. That happens every other week.
But you know what? That's partially what makes Star Trek TNG in particular an incredible show, is that the crew is willing to believe each other on outlandish things.
Yeah.
Whereas if I went to my coworkers and I said, looked at the, and I said, my God, I've got voices in my head and they're, you know, saying crazy things. You know, the immediate reaction from coworkers are like, well, that sounds insane.
You need to go to a doctor.
But in Star Trek, what happens is, okay, well, let's help you, but I believe you. You know, there's never a disbelief. And like, you look at the series finale, All Good Things.
Yeah, yeah.
Picard is saying objectively outlandish things to his crew members in three different timelines.
But they believe him.
And they're like, okay, all right, fine, let's go find Data.
Yeah.
Okay, let's go take the ship to the neutral. Oh, okay, fine. Another example is Worf, who is going to a Batleth tournament, and I'm forgetting the episode, and he's in a whole bunch of different timelines. And
parallels. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
And finally, he realizes what's going on. He's like, guys, I something is wrong.
I'm phasing in and out of this reality. And
they're like,
oh yeah,
sure.
That's chapter 6. We got to get on that.
Right. And like, and that's, I think, what made TNG such a strong show, is that it's a show about people working together.
Yeah.
You know, and that, because that's not, because you look at a lot of other ensemble shows, it's about conflict between. You know, members. Ensembles. And this is an example of where people are going to give you the benefit of the doubt.
Well, you know, there's the great counterexample. There's the episode where Picard has been kidnapped and is sent somewhere for observation, and they put a false Picard in charge.
And
he's not acting like himself. He's going to 10 forward and be like, here's to the finest crew in Starfleet. He's doing all that. So Troy and LaForge and Riker are like, are you noticing something's up with the captain? And like, when do you say something? You know, because normally he's the guy that you would die for, but mm-hmm. you're pretty sure that's not him. You just have a gut instinct.
Right.
And they have to figure out when they're going to step in. So
right.
That was always a neat one because, you know, that's like when, like you say, you have a coworker who you suddenly, you think maybe they've got a drinking problem, but you're not sure and you don't know when to say something or should you say something and blah,
right.
blah, blah. So, but that's what makes TNG great. So this is great. We've now established the top. We thought we have six, but I'm glad we had one of our top three was on both of our lists.
Yes.
So this is great. Well, listen, Sopan, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show. For those who aren't reading your work, it's in the New York Times where you... You're writing in the culture section and you're also following political matters on Twitter, which is just your name, right? It's not
Sopandeb. Okay. S-O-P-A-N-D-E-B.
Awesome. And that's a great way to follow you and interact with you and you get a lot of fans. You probably get a lot of hate tweets, but you probably get mostly mostly people that are nice to you, right?
Sure.
Well, we hope that more Star Trek people start following you if they aren't already. And thanks again for coming by, and we will see you next time.
Thanks for having me.